Day of oral argument for this panel, which has been very enjoyable. And we welcome you to the Fifth Circuit. I assume you're familiar with our lighting system. When the yellow light goes on, you should get nervous, and then when the red light goes on, you should get really nervous and stop talking. Just bad joke. We are delighted and looking forward to hearing your argument. We have two cases on our docket this morning, actually three. We'll hear two live, and then we'll take a break and hear one by Zoom, the third case. So we will call, the first case, number 21-40712, United States of America versus Mohamed Pathay Bah. Mr. Illich. Good morning.
Judge Duncan, members of the panel, and may it please the court. My name is Niles Illich, and I represent the appellant, Mohamed Bah. This appeal presents a single question, and that question is whether the district court did enough to adequately explain the two dramatic variances it imposed. For us, the answer is no. We concede, as we must, that the error was not preserved, and so we're before the court this morning on plain error review. We do believe, however, that this is one of the rare cases that can meet this unusually high standard, and we'll explain that in a moment. But I think it's useful to begin with a reminder of where we started, and that is with the guidelines. And the guidelines range for count one was 51 to 63 months. For count two, it was a minimum of 120 months, for a total of 183 months. The government asked for 600 months, and the district court imposed a sentence of life, which I've quantified at 900 months. I don't know if there's an official month quantification for that, but that's 75 years, followed by 300 months, for a total of 1,200 months. So we've gone from 187 months to 1,200 months, an increase of more than 6.5 times. The failure in this case isn't necessarily the imposition of the 1,200 months. It's the failure to explain adequately why they imposed 1,200 months. And I'll tell the court what it already knows, but it is procedural error to fail to adequately explain a sentence. And the further you get from the presumptively reasonable guidelines range, the more explanation is required. This is not new law. This is law that has been before this court and before the Supreme Court for decades. But here, when we look at the record, whether it's the statement of reasons form that was marked in Section 6 or whether it was the exchange during sentencing, we simply don't know why the sentence is what it is. Now, I think this really requires me to turn to the plain error analysis, because that's where the meat of this case is. And as the court is aware, there are really three things here. Error that's clear and plain, that affected the substantial rights, and then, of course, the exercise of discretion. I think the easiest of these for my client is to show error. And to show that it was clear and plain on the record. And that is because cases like Gall from the Supreme Court, Bostic, Smith out of this court have been very clear that if you're going to impose a sentence, the district court doesn't have to do the guidelines, of course, it can go up, but if you're going to go up, you need to explain it. And you explain the 3553A factors like nearly every district judge in this circuit does. Here, we simply don't have that explanation.
Remind me, counsel, what did the district judge say, if anything?
Yes, Judge Duncan, he gave the same answer, the same explanation for count one and count two, and that is something along the lines of, under the 3553A factors and the history and circumstances of the defendant, I'm imposing this sentence.
Right. And in your view, that's just not enough explanation. I mean, it's thin.
Yes, Judge Duncan, I don't think it's enough. And maybe if we were talking about a guideline sentence, I think you could get there. But as we deviate 6.5 times, if my 900 months is a fair number, But if we deviate 6.5 times from the presumptively reasonable guidelines range, there needs to be some explanation. And, you know, when we look...
It strikes you that, you know, look at this, it's precisely the reason we enforce the plain error rule. To reinforce the obligation to advise the court, because this, an objection made at the time, the judge would have promptly given you the explanation you wanted. So why, I have trouble escaping the plain error.
Judge Higginbotham, I understand that, and it's hard for me. I'm just in a moment of candor here that's usually not a good idea. I really looked for other issues because I didn't want to bring up a plain error issue because I recognized the problem. But that really, in my mind, goes to the fourth prong of the plain error analysis and whether this court should exercise its discretion. And typically when this court exercises its discretion and finds plain error, it's looking to something that sort of goes to the fundamental fairness, the integrity of the court system.
I think, let me just interrupt you for a second because there's a third prong.
Right? Yes, Judge.
Let's assume it's error, let's assume it's plain.
Okay.
Now, it is your burden to show that the plain error affected the defendant's substantial rights. In our case, I'm looking at Mondrian Santiago. You have to show, the defendant has to show that it affected the outcome of the district court. You have to show that a probability sufficient to undermine confidence in the outcome. Now, how do you do that in a case
sure.
like
and
that?
Judge Higginbotham, if I may come back to your point when I address the fourth prong.
They're closely related.
Yeah, I wasn't trying to preempt Judge Higginbotham. I just think that's all.
I just want to make sure I get everybody addressed. And certainly, Judge Duncan, I think prong three is the hardest prong for us because, you know, it's an alluring argument. It's a seductive argument for me to say that, look, anybody who would look to this long mental health history, I think, would find it mitigating. But I cannot point to a place in the record that shows that kind of error. So in some of the cases we've had errors where they marked a guideline sentence and then they imposed an above a guideline sentence. There you could do it. Sure. Here I cannot go to a place in the record and show you that. And that's
I appreciate it. You're right. I mean, I was an appellate attorney. It's hard to make a plain error argument, and I appreciate the candor. This is an unusual case. The variance or departure, whichever one it is dramatic. And yet, it is clear, is it not, or maybe it's not, the district court was aware of the mental health issues, right?
Judge Duncan, I will say that we know so little that I think we should say the district court should have been aware. I don't think we can say with absolute certainty that the district court was aware.
It's in the PSR, right?
It's in the PSR, and the court, of course, says it read the PSR.
It did say that.
Yes, right. Yes, in the form of reasons, it says that. But if I can go on just a little bit on prong three, and I'm not sure that I elaborated on this as well as I could have, but when I cited to the Cron case,
right.
Sean case, what I'm explaining to the court there is this idea that the affecting of substantial rights and 3553A section, I think it's C, really goes to the ability to do an effective appellate review of the sentence. And part of the showing of the effect on appellate substantial rights is that without some explanation, we don't really know how this sentence came. So criminal history, okay? He's got assault on a police officer that he got 1.4, and then he's got, like, failure to drive with a speeding ticket or something, a seatbelt on. Let's say the judge imposed a 900-month sentence because he had a ticket for driving without a seatbelt on. I would come to this court and say that's substantively unreasonable. The district court may believe that shows irresponsibility and that... and that irresponsible people need longer sentences, but we don't give 900-month sentences as enhancements usually for failing to wear a seatbelt. So the court really is prevented from doing an effective appellate review of this sentence by failing to explain, by the district court's failure to explain why it varied so highly.
And I mean, I guess the elephant in the room is the shooting the bank teller in the head, right?
Of course, Judge Duncan. And I have not shied away, and I don't shy away from that fact. And I'm not saying that my client is innocent. I'm not saying that he doesn't deserve to go to prison. I think we start with the idea that the sentencing guidelines are presumptively reasonable, which put it at, what, 183 months, which is, I think, almost 16 years. Now, is 16 years an appropriate sentence for somebody who shoots somebody else in the head?
And there's no argument that the guidelines were improperly calculated, correct?
Correct, Judge Engelhardt. No one has made that argument.
Okay, my question is, other than an improper, or I should say an erroneous, a plainly erroneous guideline calculation, are there any cases that we should look at, either controlling or persuasive, that relate to sentencing, plainly erroneous sentencings that were vacated or reversed on appeal?
I think Phillips would be one, Chan would be one. Bostic was not one. It was not a plain error. It was reversed, but I think it is, I mean, it was preserved, but I think it is a good explanation of the law, and I've included it here, but with full disclosure that it was preserved and we're not here. But I guess I would turn the court to Phillips and to Chan. But if I could turn to Judge Higginbotham's point about how hard it is to overcome plain error and the necessity and the need to encourage attorneys to make these objections contemporaneously, I think it goes to sort of the public perception of the credibility of the court. And when we see a sentence that is this dramatic, when we see a sentence that is 1,200 months, that's a sentence that the public deserves to have an explanation for. And whether the attorney messed up or whether the attorney, he certainly did, and I can do this on a writ. My writ is written right here. But it goes to the credibility of the court. The court should say why it's imposing 1,200 months. If it's because a man was shot in the head and another person had a panic attack, a near heart attack, and the court believes that's an appropriate sentence, fine, say so. But if it's because he had a speeding ticket, or if it's because he drove without insurance, that's a different matter. This goes to the credibility of the court, and that's been conventionally where this court has exercised its discretion.
But I assume that there has to be some coloration of error lurking in the background somewhere. Otherwise, we're just left from the fact that the sentence is perfectly proper within the range of the discretion of the district court. And then on the plain error doctrine, it'd be difficult to say that it affected the outcome, et cetera. So we're left with your rationale, which I appreciate, that there is an obligation that is not met inherently imposed by these rules of a public declaration, sort of an openness rule, as you argued. But I don't find that the latter point, although I take it's sound in reality in the cases, but perhaps there is one, that right particular rationale as being distinct in and of itself.
Well, and I'm not sure that it is, except for the fact of the magnitude of the distinction. And we looked at cases like Smith, that we cited in our brief, that really talk about this imperative to explain a big variance up or downwards. It's not just upwards, but up or downwards. When you're going away from that, you need it to be explained. Why does it need to be explained? It needs to be explained not only for the defendant, but for the attorneys and for the public, so that there isn't
a largely focus upon the information given to the defendant. I assume that earlier in the proceedings, the district judge had explained that he was adopting the findings of the recommendations of the probation officer report. In other words, he made some interrogation to counsel as to whether or not you've consulted with your client and reviewed da da da.
Yes, Judge Higginbotham, they went through the usual things, and then you know the admonishments, and then you have argument from the government, argument from counsel, and then two little sentences saying, explaining why. And so we believe this is one of the rare instances that meets the plain error standard. We appreciate the opportunity to speak with the court this morning. If there are no further questions, we ask the court to reverse this and remand for a new sentencing.
Thank you. Thank you. You have time for rebuttal. Let's see, sorry. Ms. Alanis.
Good morning, and may it please the court. Amy Alanis for the United States. Context is everything, including in federal sentencing matters. The Supreme Court in Rita made very clear that where a matter is conceptually simple and the record makes clear the district court considered the evidence, the district court does not have to give extensive reasons for its sentencing decision.
So do you think there's any error here at all?
I would say only to the extent that you can actually separate prongs one and two.
They're two prongs.
Right. So if we were under preserved error, yes, if we're only looking at error, but I don't believe this error is clear and obvious given the context here. This man walked into a bank. He didn't say a word. Within 5 seconds, he had pulled out a 22 handgun loaded with 10 hollow point bullets, and he shot the teller in the face.
Hey, I fully recognize that. I mean, it's the difficulty here is the extent of the upward variance, which seems dramatic.
It is dramatic.
It's dramatic. And we have a case, I was just reading from Mondragon Santiago from 2009, that says, okay, well, if there's no explanation and it's a within guidelines sentence, well, we're not going to find, on plain error review, we're not going to find substantial rights have been affected. But this is not a within guidelines sentence.
Right.
To the contrary.
Mondragon Santiago was still within the guidelines, right. So it's a little different here. But it's not just the egregious facts of the case. There are a lot of other things going on. And you asked defense counsel what the district court actually said. Mm-hmm. For both counts, he says, count one, I am doing an upper variance. And he repeats this twice. For count one and count two, he says, pursuant to 3553A1, the nature and circumstances of the offense and the history and characteristics of the defendant, I am going to upwardly depart. And I think one thing that's really important about this case is there wasn't any serious mitigation evidence offered. Baugh himself refused to allocute. He did not say a word. He didn't apologize. He didn't try to, you know, make excuses for himself. His defense lawyer did as well as he could, but basically he tries to float the idea that, well, my client is mentally ill. Well, that was pretty neatly debunked by the competency exam, in which the psychiatrist examined him and found no schizophrenia, no mental illness, and no mental deficiency. And then the other thing that was offered was, well, he had 9 other hollow point bullets in the gun, but he didn't hurt anyone else. I mean, that's kind of weak when you look at what happened here. What would there be to explain in the case? Here, this judge, who is a seasoned district judge, he looked at this guy and he knew the whole history of this case, and he just thought that even the prosecution's recommended sentence simply wasn't enough. This is not a case.
He didn't get into that, right? Did the judge explain why he thought I know the prosecution was asking for an upward variance.
Yes.
And you're saying the judge obviously didn't think that was enough because it went beyond that. Did he address that?
He did not specifically address it, but the prosecutor, he filed a written notice of intent to seek upward departure or variance. That was done even before the PSR was complete. Mm-hmm. And then at sentencing, he gave a very eloquent explanation. He went into a lot of detail about why an upward variance was appropriate.
Yeah, no, we've got it right here. This bank robbery was a serious and vicious event, and the upward variance is necessary to protect this community from the individual.
Yes. And I know we're all so inured to hearing terrible things in the news about violence and, you know, terrible incidents, but, you know, in federal court, it doesn't happen that often that someone walks into a bank and just shoots somebody in the head. I mean, this is really an extraordinary case. Mm. So I think that is a huge factor, too.
What's your best case, best precedent you could point to that the explanation here was sufficient to the extent you're arguing that.
Well, I think it's Judge Higginbotham's opinion in Fraga. That's a good one. And also Key. In Fraga, again, it was, you know, it relies on Rita, that language in Rita, that when it's really clear, and I mean, nobody disputes the evidence. Again, there really wasn't any serious mitigation that was presented. So it was just, it wasn't clear and obvious error. And also the case Key, where they talk about the district court in the statement of reasons can incorporate the government's motion, and that happened here too. And if I could just talk for—
That seems important to me. Can you say Key? The district, we could read the district court as incorporating, what did you say?
In the statement of reasons, the district court specified, you know, this upward departure was made on the motion of the government, and that occurred, the government made that argument twice, and its notice of intent, and also its sentencing, made a very full explanation of why that was necessary. There was also a case called Key. That is Key, where they talk about the statement of reasons. And there are a couple other minor cases, Segura, Osorio, Abundis. And also, on the third prong, actually a case that he relies on, I think is actually really good for the government in this case, the Chan case.
Why do you think Chan is good for you?
Well, it comes down to the third prong in that case. And so, again, the court, instead of looking at it as a first or second prong case, it looks at that statement of reasons again and say, look, you know, this is good enough. You can't show that your rights were substantially harmed because the statement of reasons incorporates the government's argument, and they're all in the record. So I think those are our best cases.
Okay.
Counsel, if we wanted to agree with you, but were concerned that we were forgiving district judges, giving them a very low bar to clear, what could you tell us that would make us feel a little more comfortable with the idea that this was sufficient for purposes of sentencing?
Well, I think this is an extraordinary case. The facts are extraordinary. The defendant was extraordinary. He didn't even allocute. The mitigation, there's really no serious mitigation here. I think you can distinguish this case, you know, as the extraordinary case it is, and not and make it clear that district judges really do need to be explaining things a little better. I mean, I don't think anybody would say that isn't true, but I think it's distinguishable.
And one of the difficulties is our formulating rules from up here and translating to the reality of the courtroom and the sentencing dockets is difficult. This is one case, and I don't know how many out of his docket, but many of these judges have 15 or 20.
Oh, yes.
Cases to be sentenced, et cetera, et cetera. And you've got the PSR, and it's got all that detail in it. We required the district judges to inquire and make clear on the record that this has been reviewed with them, et cetera, et cetera. That still leaves open the step up. But in the review of that, it is plain that this is a permissible, legally permissible sentence, and that's within the range itself. And what was argued to what did the defendant argue to the judge about the sentence?
Even the defense counsel.
I'm sorry?
Defense counsel admitted at sentencing that an upward variance was appropriate, and I think he asked for a total of 242 months, which would have been the mandatory 10 on the firearm, and then so that would be about 10 years on the...
So the colloquy then was about upward variance.
Yes. Everyone knew there was going to be one because his guideline range on the armed bank robbery was only 21 to 27 months.
Well, did any of that colloquy include the range of going all the way to the max?
I'm sorry?
Did that colloquy about upward departure contemplate that it would go as far as this did?
I don't think so. I mean, admittedly, the judge imposed even more than the prosecution asked for. The prosecution asked for 25 on both, which would have been the max on the robbery and then 25 consecutive. So admittedly, he did not explain why he thought it was deserving of even more than that. So if there are no further questions, we would ask the court to affirm.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Illick, you have some time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Judge Duncan. Very quickly, 3 points. First, counsel says there was no evidence of mitigation. And I think that's simply not true. When we look at the PSR, there's a long history of mental health problems. He's institutionalized for 8 months. He's given a long-acting psychotropic drug. There is a long history. The judge, of course, didn't have to believe that. We simply don't know whether he believed it or not. The tension between the evidence of his mental health history and the finding that he wasn't actively suffering from schizophrenia when he was examined by the court-appointed psychologist is something the judge should have explained. Look, I don't buy the prior mental health issue. I think he did this, you know, as a normal, healthy human being. That's different. We need to know that. We don't need to know that. Talking about Key and Fraga, which I think, Judge Duncan, you said that was an important point to you on Key. And what I want to make sure is clear about Key is that the government sentencing argument discussed exhaustively the 3553A factors. So this idea that we're going to go up was addressed exhaustively in the government's sentencing argument in Key, in the notice of intent to move upward. Here, it's a single page. Here, we don't have an exhaustive discussion. At most, it says, it should go up because of the guidelines, the use of a dangerous weapon, and the background characteristics. It just doesn't do the exhaustive discussion that we see in
We know that defense Key. Counsel didn't lodge an objection. What was the defense counsel's posture at the sentencing? What were they arguing?
The arguments were, look, he suffered from mental health. I mean, this is a guy who moves from North Carolina to Harlingen, robs a bank on a gold Huffy bike. You know, I mean, to me, that's almost facially some sign of mental health problems. But it focused on that during the argument. And admittedly, I think you're right, Judge Higginbotham. There probably were 15 sentences that morning. They did maybe 3 or 4 minutes for the government.
It's the rejection of that argument that you say is the difficulty here. That is that he went to the max. He rejected the mental difficulties, deficiencies, which are certainly highly relevant.
And I struggled with that, Judge Higginbotham, but I don't think, I ultimately concluded, I don't think we can agree that he rejected that. We just don't know why. Perhaps the sentence comes from the fact that my client had a ticket for speeding or not wearing a seatbelt. We can assume, and it would be rational to do it, to impose a sentence like this because you rejected the mental health history, but we don't know from the record that the court did reject it. And that's the essence.
Part of the court's obligation to explain his discharge by the nature of the argument that's made. Defense counsel is arguing that this fellow has this poor mental history, et cetera, et cetera. He doesn't know what he's doing, da da da. He needs treatment. Incarceration is not the answer, et cetera. And then the district judge, when he turns and rejects that by the high sentence, then why isn't that sufficient? In other words, it's the full context of the character.
Judge Higginbotham, if we had had an explanation that he did in fact reject the mental health history, right, that the district court says, I don't agree that he had ever had mental health problems. His family was wrong to put him in mental health treatment. He never had that. Okay, fine. That would help us understand that he rejected it. Here, we simply...
What I'm suggesting to you simply is what do you say to the suggestion that is implicit in his rejection given the argument that's made?
I would say that we cannot get from A to B to C on that. I do not think we can conclude from the fact that the court imposed this large sentence that it necessarily rejected the mental health thing. It may be that the court rejected that. That would make a lot of logical sense, right? But it may also be that the court imposed this sentence because my client had a ticket for driving without a driver's license. Now, I realize that's an extreme example, but it is to illustrate the point that we simply don't know, and may I finish my answer here?
Yes.
We simply don't know why the court did it. We don't know whether it's a rejection of mental health. We simply don't know, and that's why we ask this court respectfully for relief.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you for a well-argued case.
Thank you for having
both sides, and we take the matter under submission.
Thank you for having us. Excuse me.